Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions that you've left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. I've been using my show for a couple announcements before I get going into questions, and I'll do that this time. I wanted to let everybody know that some time ago I promised a video on the e-meter, and this is meant to be quite a, you know, like sort of for me, the sort of the be-all end-all of videos on the e-meter, and so I am putting that together now. That project went on hold when I was working on my book because my book took up all my time in terms of research and whatnot, and I really wanted to do this e-meter thing justice. So I wanted everybody to know I picked back up on that. It's not going to be ready next week or even the week after that. It's going to be, you know, it's a project and it's a big one. So I'll be putting content out, obviously on my schedule, but I am working on that sort of behind the scenes in the same way I was working on my book. So that's happening. And I really hope you guys are going to like the output on the final result on that. Also, I wanted to let everybody know about something that that I think is important. There are not a lot of counselors or trained therapists who deal with people who have been in destructive cults. It's kind of surprising that that is that way, that there are just a few who actually know what they're doing, but that's how it is. And as I've been kind of, you know, getting my feelers out there and learning who these people are and making contact with them and making friends with them and whatnot, I've been finding out who these guys are and what it's all about in that whole world. And I got a lot still to learn. I'm not saying that I'm sitting here knowing everybody involved in this, but because there are so few who actually know what they're doing, what ends up happening in the world is somebody who, you know, has been in a destructive cult or in a abusive group or an abusive relationship, cult type situation, can go to, you know, a regular therapist or a regular counselor who doesn't have any background or knowledge in destructive cult techniques or how they actually operate or the dynamics of them, and not really get the help that they need, because they end up, you know, having to instruct their therapist on what kind of group they were involved in and how it all worked. And they really shouldn't have to do that. Your therapist that you go to should know about those things. So, you know, I don't know that I'm saying that, you know, you shouldn't go to a therapist at all. I'm not advising that. If you, you know, have found a therapist that helps you, absolutely, you know, go for it. That's not my point here. My point is that I think therapists who understand the situation and understand the mind control techniques and the undue influence that is exerted on cult members will have a better chance of successfully giving therapy or counseling to somebody who's been involved in those groups. That's my point. And on that line, I've interviewed Rachel Bernstein on this channel, and she is one such therapist, and she's actually starting a support group for ex-members of destructive cult groups or destructive groups. And she's based out of Los Angeles, and I've put her contact data in the notes section below for this show, because I want you guys to know that if you're in that area, then you can contact her and see about getting involved in that support group. You can't just show up, you're going to have to talk to her first. And also, she is available for, you know, over the internet or long distance consulting, right? So that's, anyway, just letting you know she's out there. And now that I've said that, and by the way, that was not a paid endorsement. Rachel's just a friend. That all being said, let's get on with your questions now. Andy Lesser, I was wondering if you might be able to compare and contrast destructive cults such as Scientology with groups such as the Marine Corps, fraternities, or the police force. I can see that there are some big differences. For example, there is no enforced disconnection if you choose to leave these groups. However, I think that there are a lot of similarities too. I've been really interested lately in the way that mind control tactics are used to build group loyalty in settings outside of what we might consider traditional cults. Would love to hear your insights into this. Well, there's certainly no question about it. A person doesn't have to be involved in a religious group or organization in order to be involved in, a group that is using undue influence or mind control techniques or thought coercion in order to get its members aligned with what that group is trying to do. We see this in politics, in social groups, as I've said before, schools. I mean, this comes out in kind of anywhere where groups can form. You can end up with a leader or leaders and followers who end up in this kind of strange dynamic or relationship where there is an undue amount of influence. And I think that's really the judgment factor, the point of decision as to whether somebody is involved in a group that is constructive for them or destructive for them, is the degree of undue influence that has to be exerted on them in order to get them to be part of the group, stay with the group, not leave the group, and work for and do the things that the group leaders are telling them to do. I thought I would pull up the list of the checklist of cult characteristics as written out by Janja Lalić, that I have referred to before and actually made a video using. I'm not going to go through all the points here, but just some of the points that you could, and I'll put a link to this in the notes section of this video, but some of the points that you can look at on this checklist when you're weighing out whether a group is a destructive cult or not is things like, the group displays excessively zealous and unquestioning commitment to its leader, whether alive or dead, right, regarding the belief system, ideology, and practices. Or questioning, doubt, and dissent are discouraged or even punished. Number three, mind-altering practices are used in excess and serve to suppress doubts about the group and its leaders. And here we're talking about such things as meditation, chanting, denunciation sessions, or debilitating work routines are examples of the kind of things we're talking about there. The leadership dictates, sometimes in great detail, how members should think, act, and feel. For example, members must get permission to date, change jobs, marry, or leaders prescribe what types of clothes to wear, where to live, whether or not to have children, how to discipline children, and so forth. So, you have these different characteristics that you can sort of look at. And a destructive group doesn't have to, or a cult doesn't have to meet every one of these characteristics. Like, for example, there's another one on here about how they're, have an excessive amount of attention on money. Or another one on, a lot of attention on getting new members, right? So you look at something like the Marine Corps or the police force, and I don't see those groups as destructive cults. I see that there are definitely individuals in those groups who will engage in coercion or maybe use some methods of undue influence or psychological influence on people. I mean, what's boot camp? That's definitely breaking down a person's personality in a number of ways. But a person is, comes into it and is always free to leave. I mean, there isn't, you have a procedure to leave such a group, right? And then there isn't disconnection, and there are not, they're not going to stalk you and harass you and try to ruin your life if you don't want to be a Marine anymore, that sort of thing. Yes, there is an excessive amount of belief, I guess you could say, developed or fostered in those kind of groups because you're trying to get people into a position, especially in the military, where you're trying to get people into a position where they're willing to kill for an idea or for a belief system or for a nation, right? Yes, there are mind control techniques used by such groups that you said in your question, Andy. And so you really have to look at or value, judge a group by their purpose. Is their purpose what they say their purpose is? Their goals, are they achieving their goals? Are their stated goals constructive or destructive? Are there real goals, constructive or destructive, right? And I'm, again, not going to get into the military as an aspect because this applies to any group. This could apply to, you know, the Boy Scouts. This could apply to some cheerleaders, you know, I mean, a cheer squad. Any group could devolve into a destructive cult situation, and any group could use mind control techniques without being a destructive cult. And any group can also just be constructive 100%, be totally above the boards, totally open about what they're doing, and be completely voluntary and not use any methods of undue influence at all. So, you know, there's a scale there, but I think those are ways that you could, you know, kind of gauge or judge what you're looking at. Leo Taxel. I know Scientology has anywhere from 20 to 50,000 members currently based on what numbers you believe for current membership, but what was Scientology's absolute peak membership and what year was that? I can't find that anywhere. I think it's an important question because it would reveal how much undue influence this cult had at its peak. Thanks for your answer, even if it's just an educated guess or citing someone else. I don't have an exact figure that I can give you that's authoritative. I'll tell you what I think. This is my educated guess. I believe that Scientology was at its peak in the late 1970s and early 1980s before there was kind of an implosion with certain events that occurred at that time. And for those in the know, I'm talking about like the Mission Holders Conference blow up and the fallout from Operation Snow White and the whole change up of management and the way that, you know, the church lost a lot of people during that time. The David Mayo, who was the senior technical person in the church, was cast out and he took a bunch of people with him. Not out of church management. I mean, a bunch of Scientologists, public Scientologists followed him rather than continue with the actual church. So, that all happened in the early mid 1980s. So I believe that that's why that just before that was its peak period. And I think that here's, I would say maybe 150, 200,000 members worldwide at its peak. And I think that's going to be sometime in the 70s. And I think that's pretty high. That's probably a high estimate, right? It doesn't have to be that high. It could have been as high as it, down to maybe 100,000 active members I'm talking about now. One thing I look at on that as far as a number to sort of look at is I think the largest central files, which is when somebody comes into the Church of Scientology and buys a book or does a service, if they buy anything, a folder is made with their name and address on it. Their name and address is collected on the invoice. A folder is made, and that invoice is put in the folder, and then people start writing to that person to encourage them to do more Scientology services. That's the way that they use those files. And the central files folder is supposed to be a representation of the person to the organization. It's kind of a, you know, pre-internet, pre-computers sort of database system. The name, let's say the person came in at Santa Barbara and he bought a book. Okay, so that name of that guy, Joe Schmo, and his address and phone number gets reported to a higher organization in Los Angeles. And they put that name and address in their central files because it's a higher up. That name doesn't go to Denver. It goes to the higher organization in Los Angeles. That organization was called the American St. Hill Organization, which was an organization I was involved in. Then all those names are supposed to, I believe, go to the flag service organizations, central files in Florida. And this is the reason why people will end up getting mail from lots of different places in Scientology, is because the name gets sent up the line, so to speak. Now, the reason I'm explaining all that is because you get this aggregate of all these names from all over the Western United States and Mexico and Canada coming into this place in Los Angeles, the American St. Hill Organization. It had a very, very large central files for Scientology. And I believe, if I'm remembering this right, that it was about 550, 600,000 names, somewhere around there. Maximum, if I'm remembering this wrong, was about 700,000 names, right? That were file folders in ASHO's, the American St. Hill organization's ASHO's central files. So that's how many people in this Western Hemisphere ever purchased something from Scientology, 750,000 people. So, or 700,000, right, max. So based on that figure from like going back all the way to 1950, all the way to present, and knowing what I know about active membership and how many people were actually around doing services, you know, when I came on in 1985 doing my first services in Santa Barbara, and I joined staff in 1987. So I started kind of getting an idea of staff and that sort of thing. Like the Santa Barbara organization's central files was, I don't know, maybe 12,000 names, something like that. Like the whole time Santa Barbara operated, that's how many people it sold things to. And by far the vast majority of those names came from book sales, not from service sales or courses or auditing. It was just books. And you don't count somebody who buys a book as a Scientologist, at least if you have, you know, a couple gray cells to rub together. So if you look at the vast majority of those central files folders as just book buyers, which they are, then it comes way down to how many people were actually active Scientologists. And that's kind of looking at all that information is where I got that sort of educated guess from. So that's my best answer for you. Adam West, thank you again for all the good work. Have you seen the movie with Harvey Keitel called Holy Smoke? He plays a cult deprogrammer. What do you make of such practices ethically and morally? Also, are you familiar with the reality tunnel concept and with R.A. Wilson? Okay, Adam, well, I had not seen Holy Smoke until you asked me this question, and for the sake of my, you know, good Q&A show here, I decided to watch this movie. I'd seen ads for it and stuff. I was a little curious about it. It's a 1999 movie made by Jane Campion with her sister, and it takes place in Australia, and it involves Kate Winslet playing a woman who goes from Australia. She's in a very dysfunctional family, and she ends up in India, and she joins a guru's group up there, which, you know, looks kind of cult-like. And then she, her mother freaks out over this because she, you know, her traveling companion comes back to Australia and tells the mother, oh my God, she's joined a cult and rah, 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 and she's going to get married to this guy and the guru, right, who's going to marry like all of his followers and all this. And anyway, Harvey Keitel appears on the scene at the mother's request. And he is a cult deprogrammer, and he, you know, gets her, he arranges with the family to sort of abduct her and get her out in the middle of nowhere, where he can gets her agreement to spend 3 days with him so that he can deprogram her, break her, as he and she put it. I found the movie extremely distasteful and offensive, really, because that is not at all what a cult intervention looks like or should be like. Everything that guy did from the moment he came on screen, Harvey Keitel's character, rubbed me the wrong way, if not outright pissed me off, because he was talking about how he had to induce a traumatic episode with her in order to snap her out of her cult think and this sort of thing. And that is just absolutely not at all how I think or how one should approach somebody who's in a destructive cult group and get them out of it. You're not going to break a person. You've already got somebody who's been broken. I mean, you've got somebody in a destructive cult who, by definition, is under undue influence and, you know, or brainwashing or mind control or whatever terminology you want to use. They're not thinking according to like their own feelings and their own personality. That's what being a destructive cult is. It's taking on the persona of the cult leader to one degree or another and changing one's views to align with, you know, you're going this way and then suddenly you're going this way because you are being lied to and deceived. That's an inherent part of of being in a destructive cult, right? So to think that you're going to take somebody in that condition and then snap them out of it by some kind of harsh ice water dip where you're going to kidnap them and traumatize them out of that is ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, in the 1970s and 80s is when that sort of, you know, this sort of kidnapping thing was going on with deprogramming. I don't even like that word. But that's where that sort of thing, that's when that sort of thing happened. That, you know, people who do cult interventions or try to assist people out of those situations, they don't even do that crap anymore and haven't for 20 years. So, you know, to put that in a movie in 1999, I came to find out in researching this that almost every TV show, news show, or movie that is portrayed getting somebody out of a cult situation would only portray a kidnapping situation, despite how unrealistic it is, because they felt that a non-coercive intervention wasn't dramatic enough. Then nobody would want to watch that, you know, because it looks like a conversation. It looks like a rational, normal, real conversation between people. You know, that's how you actually do it. And you don't do it by forcing a person to sit at a table and barring the door and restricting their freedoms. You'll never succeed at doing a cult intervention by taking away a person's human rights. That's just a ridiculous idea. So, because that's the very thing you're trying to get them out of, you know. So anyway, so unfortunately, this practice and this how it's done is not being portrayed in the media properly or realistically at all. And that's on purpose. Like the editors and the people who put these movies together or the news shows together just are not interested in how it's done properly. They want drama. They want conflict. They want to see people getting thrown into black vans and being driven off to hotel rooms and doors being locked with security guards and whatnot. And I'm just telling you that the number of times that was done was like this many compared to this many times that non-coercive measures were used and are used now to convince people to leave. And here's the other thing is that's only this amount compared to this amount of people who actually leave on their own. So the number of times intervention is needed is actually so small. And then the number of times that, you know, forceful, coercive techniques have been used to do that is even tinier. But that's what gets all the attention. So anyway, enough of my tirade about that. As far as the movie goes, I found it I'm a total cinephile. I love movies. And I found this movie to be incredibly obtuse and not well put together. The characters were, every one of them, cardboard cutouts or stereotypes. The Australians particularly were not well served by this movie. They were every single one of them was portrayed as a complete moron. I thought the only character that came through as realistic was the woman who played Kate Winslet's mother. Her caring and her love for her daughter and whatnot definitely was there. And in fact, the scene where she's talking to her daughter in a very loving and trying to understand and they're really having an actual conversation, that was as close as it got to what a real intervention would have looked like. And then, you know, along comes Mr. Tough Guy Interventionist and the family, and they all just pick her up and take her out. And it was just absolutely ludicrous. And as far as the reality tunnel concept, boy, I could spend a whole show talking about that. Holy cow. R.A. Wilson and his philosophy and his writings and viewpoints about things are absolutely fascinating. He's got way too much to talk about very easily, so I'll just say I'm very impressed with him and his sort of very counterculture, but very, I thought, inspired and very intelligent views on things. I like the guy, and I like a lot of what he had to say, not everything, but a lot. And And the reality tunnel concept is something I very much could get behind as a as an idea of how people see the world and whatnot. I totally agree with that. Cormac Conway, I know Scientologists aren't supposed to discuss their own cases, so what do they talk to one another about? Is it as jargon-heavy as I imagine it would be? And is there an element of snobbery among public based on their place on the bridge or IAS status? Are there any policies or guiding principles as to when the love bombing stops and the berating of public begins? That's a good question. Yes, public do talk to one another. Scientologists do talk to one another heavily with the jargon. It is their language, after all, and they use it. And to them, they can't think of any other way to communicate some of those concepts that they think are so special and that they have secret knowledge of. And I'm not even going to bother repeating any of it right now. I'll just confuse the hell out of everybody. But there is also very definitely a caste system within Scientology and amongst the public Scientologists. Okay, you have public, staff, Sea Org. Okay, so that's your three basic levels of Scientologist. And that's important to understand because a lot of the abuses and the human rights trafficking and the slavery and the wages and all that stuff, that applies up here to the Sea Org and to a lesser degree to the staff, not so much to the public. The disconnection and the breaking up families and all that sort of thing, and the ethics stuff and the mindset and all that, that's multicast. That's everybody, all Scientologists, that stuff applies to. So, but the long, grueling hours and all that sort of thing, people get confused about this, and they really shouldn't, because this system is pretty understandable, right? It all has to do with levels of dedication to the cause. And so when you're at this level, the public level, your basic sacrifice and the thing that you're giving more than anything else is money. Scientologists at this level, the public Scientologists, are very used to just paying and paying and paying and being asked over and over and over again for their money. That is the number one thing that happens at that public level. The staff are kind of in the middle of this thing, right? The staff are not giving money as much as public, although they are definitely browbeaten for money and for monetary contributions all the time. But they're also dedicating their time. They're working for the organizations. And they're working for the lower level organizations, for the city churches, right? So they're getting orders heaped down on them by the upper level, by the C organization. And so they're feeling all that pressure all the time, and they're constantly, you know, the Sea Org is never happy with them. They're never doing enough. They're never dedicated enough. And then you have this upper, higher tier, which is the Sea Organization, which is the core group of Scientology. And they're the ones who are always browbeating these guys. And that's where they are full-time 24/7 and all that. Okay. The within these groups, you have sub-castes, right, or sub-tiers. So with the public, you have The system is basically based around how much money you've given. So if you're, you know, a big donor who's always, you know, pulling out the Benjamins to hand them over to the IAS, or paying for lots of services and paying for, you know, things like that because you got a big checkbook, you have more status. Scientology, you know, rains more status down upon you as a good guy because you're supporting the cause with your money. And they give them little pins, and they give them labels and badges and titles and things like this, right? That's why there's all this title glorification amongst the International Association of Scientologists when they, you know, move up in status, when they pay more money, right? And eventually you get patron and patron meritorious and patron with honors and patron gloratorious and all this, you know, and diamond invictus and all this other nonsense. That they just come up with these titles because they're running out of them as far as I can tell. But that's the caste system within the public sector, right? So that's what that's based on. And people who can give a lot of money are seen in the public realm as more dedicated to the cause and more worthy of admiration. And that's really the big thing amongst this whole system, is it's all about admiration and being admired. And this is why I wrote an article called End for Narcissism. This is how Scientology develops narcissism amongst its members is it actually pushes for narcissistic behavior, because it pushes this idea that you should be admired by your fellows, you know, for doing all this stuff, right? So that's kind of how that works. As far as the love bombing, I guess I would say that once a person has been exposed to the Keeping Scientology Working policy, it's a policy letter in Scientology that Scientologists read over and over and over again. But the first exposure to it is when you do your first major services. When you first get into Scientology, you're down in the basic course room and you're doing beginning and introductory level services, and you're not seeing any of this heavy duty stuff. And there's just hints, and you know, they start giving it to you bits at a time, right? And you can watch any of my interviews, which I've done with other, you know, former members, who they'll describe the whole process. So like the current one I'm doing with Tim DeWall, right? So it begins gradually, but then by the point you're starting on major services and you're kind of in the big boy circle, that's when the love bombing sort of becomes, starts switching over to, this is your duty, this is for the good of mankind, this is your responsibility, right? And it's not so much how wonderful and great you are, although that's always included in it too. It's not like that ever goes away. The love bombing persists all the way through for the public. But the duty stuff and the, you know, getting more hardcore and getting more dedicated and keeping Scientology working, you know, that sort of idea starts coming in harder the higher you go up that bridge to total freedom. And it's time for flash answers. Monty Ollie. Chris, I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about how you dodged the foul mouth bullet. Watching Tim DeWall talk in the interview you did with so many expletives and bad attitudes reminds me how that really was the culture, and so few people didn't talk like that. You never seemed to talk like that. Did you when you were in? Is it a conscious choice not to now? Totally conscious choice. I actually have a total potty mouth, and when I'm not on camera, I use it all the time. But I chose not to use that approach in my videos. I don't back off or tell other people not to use that language, but I kind of keep it PG because I want to appeal to as many people as I can when I'm talking. Matt Lilly, what I would like to know is, how do they answer census questions? In particular, here in Australia, where the last census put their membership at just over 2,500 and Jedi at over 65,000. I can't understand how they can explain this, as to me, they would want their members to proudly announce they were Scientologists. Seems to me, if I were a Scientologist, I would be asking, how can this be? But Matt, that is how many Scientologists there are in Australia. At most. They're not hiding their numbers. They're not, you know, walking in single file to keep the, you know, keep anybody from knowing how many of them there are. They would be, you know, if they were 65,000 Scientologists in Australia, they'd be screaming from the rooftops. But they're not, because there aren't hardly any of them there. Amanda Burke, when Sea Org members get married, most very young, is it legal, as in do they go and get a marriage license? Do they have ceremonies? And when there is forced disconnection or someone leaves, are there legal divorce processes? Yes and yes. Marriages in Scientology are always legally done. There are always services. Usually there's even a Scientology marriage ceremony. And when people break up or when there is disconnection enforced, then divorce is mandatory. Like, for example, when I left the Sea Org, I had to divorce my wife. Robert Tobias. If the goal of Scientology is to clear the planet, it would seem to me that they would be happy to provide their literature and auditing at no charge. The majority of residents of the planet Earth could never afford their fees, so by definition, the mission and spiritual goals of Scientology can never be realized. Yeah, kind of funny that, huh? I wonder if that actually says something about their real purpose here on Earth. Yeah, don't know. Key Lime Van Buren. Who came up with the design aesthetic that seems to be so prevalent in Scientology? Taste is clearly subjective, but the pillars, ivy, and near ubiquitous gold electroplate are almost baroque in their excess. What you're looking at there is 100% David Miscavige. He is the art designer for Scientology, and every single thing that you see come out or presented to the public of Scientology or the world at large went through him and was approved by him and most likely was originated as a design concept by him. Okay, so we've come to the end of another episode of our Critical Q&A. Thank you very much for hanging around and watching. If you haven't yet purchased my book, Scientology A to Xenu, An Insider's Guide to What Scientology is Really All About, then I would encourage you to do so. It's on Amazon. And yes, the audiobook recording of that is happening. I'm up to chapter 9 right now on recording that, so I'm going to keep going on that and hopefully in a couple weeks have that released as an audiobook. So that is in progress. So lots of things going on here at Shelton Studios with this and with other subjects and topics as well. You're going to see some other stuff coming out. You've already seen some on my podcast if you've been checking that out. If you haven't, please do check out my podcast. But you are going to see other topics than Scientology, other groups, destructive cult groups and whatnot being talked about here. So stay tuned for that, and I will see you guys next week. Bye-bye.